Hello and welcome to Awaaz Do, the live show. In a few minutes, we're going to start our panel discussion around freedom of speech and expression on the internet, featuring Dhanya Rajendran, who is the editor of The News Minute, Urmila Palat, a human rights lawyer and researcher and founder of How Revealing, Sunil Abraham, the executive director and center for the Center of Internet and Society, Angarika Guha from MARA, the Media and Arts Collective, and our moderator is Nayantara Ranganathan from the Internet Democracy Project.
So my first question to the panelists is basically, what do you make of this tension between the internet as an enabler of free speech and expression on the one hand, and on the other hand, that it's actively compromising many democratic institutions on the other? So if you can keep it at 3 minutes, that would be great. But anyone wants to take this?
Okay, so I mean, I would rather if Sunil started the discussion, but he wants to go next, I guess. So I think the internet is an enabler of freedom of expression, of freedom of speech. And at the same time, the internet is an enabler of hate. That's not new to us. But I would say, like all other institutions where we have dealt with hate and of course, spreading the values of democracy, we have dealt with those problems when it comes to those institutions also. And this whole problem of the internet being an enabler of both, which is hate and freedom of speech, I think it's almost like the nature of knowledge itself. Information itself, and knowledge and information can be helped to strengthen democratic institutions. They can also be used to further oppression. Now, how do we deal with it, these institutions? And I think the internet also, we will find solutions. I'm still an optimist. I think we will find solutions to this. And in my mind, overthinking and overplaying the whole factor about how internet is enabling hate takes away from the fact that the internet is crucial in other ways in actually furthering democracy. So I would like to look at it that way. I believe that as more and more hate is spreading on the internet, there are also a lot of people who use the same platform to actually counter that hate. So this is going to be a cycle, a very important cycle. There are going to be people who will use the internet to further democracy. There are going to be people who use the internet to further their agenda of hatred. And there are going to be an equal number of people who use the same platform to counter that hate. And I think with time, we will figure out more ways to counter hate. But clamping down on the internet is not going to be the solution.
Thanks, Dhanya. Does anyone else want to go?
No, Sunil has to volunteer.
People are going.
No, please go.
Lot of pressure. The trouble with both democracy and also the internet, at least in my view, is that increasingly they can be gamed. The internet is more gameable today than it was, as Nayantara said in the beginning, because it's super centralized. There are few companies that control most of what we consider networked public sphere. And two of those companies are actually surveillance giants. They're following us no matter where we go on the internet. Increasingly, what they offer anybody else is a highly targeted messaging service. So if you want to target people that are searching for a very specific term or interest, you can do that today. So both political parties and all sorts of extremist groups are all gaming the internet. And democracy is equally gameable. I was thinking of this women's rights group in Singapore. And for a long time, they were supporting women's rights. And overnight, because they're a democratic institution, members from a local church registered en masse and then voted as a single block and took over this women's rights organization. So you have a gameable internet and a gameable democracy, and that's all. It works perfectly together, basically. So that's the future we should be looking at. Thank you.
So take on from what Sunil said, I'm going to talk about a different aspect of this. the sort of tension that's created and the increasing divide that is coming up because of issues of access to the internet. And in my work, which is human rights advocacy, we see that it's becoming very, very difficult for certain causes, especially causes considered against the state, so state violence, police torture, things like that, to push for advocacy in this in these areas, because activists who are more often than not grassroots activists do not have access to the internet, do not have access to tools for marketing their causes online. They don't even have access to basic or knowledge about basic uses of platforms such as Facebook and Twitter. Forget how to use that for activism. So we see now a very different kind of effect that it has on democracy itself and a kind of hierarchy it creates on social justice issues. And that's, I think, going to get increasingly difficult over time, as Sunil says, due to gamification, due to the fact that, ads are central to this economy. And of course, the increasing dangers of surveillance on human rights work itself that we all know is, and not just state surveillance, but also private surveillance. So, yeah.
Thanks, Angarika.
Hi. Okay, so I'm just going to take off actually from what Urmila was saying, but maybe try and look at it from another side of the picture, which is that often I think with free speech and questions of freedom of expression, we look at it as a content question, but I think it's also worthwhile to consider it as a infrastructural question and look at it in terms of access to communication technologies. And that is quite skewed in the country. So whether it be between urban areas and rural areas, whether it's the tele-density, whether it's access to broadband and spectrum. I think something that we have to consider when we talk about free speech is who has access to the infrastructure that enables free speech and communication. Taking from that also, a second point would be how existing social relations kind of also play out in our usage of the internet. So I think sometimes there is a tendency, whilst the internet is very enabling, there's a tendency to position it as sort of a almost utopic public sphere. But in most cases, the internet also already mirrors whatever would be systems of social inequities and inequalities that sort of exist. So to get example would be in terms of women's access to technology. So particularly in rural India, high chances are that it's the men who kind of own the phone or have access to money to recharge data packs or whatever it is. So the woman, in all likelihood, doesn't have access to technology at all. So I think another thing to maybe consider is how the internet feeds off, perpetuates, and in certain cases could also deepen existing social material relations of inequality.
Thanks. So what I kept hearing from a lot of the panelists is there is no kind of exceptionalism about the internet, that it often kind of mirrors the existing social scenarios. So then I want to go back to the law and the freedom of speech and expression in the Constitution. There is a misconception that free speech means unhindered, unfettered speech, and that's not true. The same article that enshrines freedom of speech and expression, in fact, says that there can be reasonable restrictions. But this thing of reasonable restrictions might not have anything to do with what you and I consider reasonable. And it's, in fact, a legal standard that has history and whatnot. So I want to go to Urmila and ask, how has the internet complicated this standard of reasonable restrictions, if it at all has?
So I'll just quickly go through some of the reasonable restrictions on free speech, which is sedition, sort of incitement to, imminent violence, contempt of court, defamation, including criminal defamation, hate speech, public order, morality, decency, obscenity. So these are all kind of the, areas which really complicate things for us, because a lot of them are quite overbroad, open to various kinds of interpretation depending on who's interpreting. And on the internet itself, of course, this has complicated things tremendously for us, because now it's not just the state that is imposing restrictions on free speech. They're private corporations. And there is, you know, a sort of privatization of regulation, of censorship in a way. And, you know, Facebook, WhatsApp, Twitter are all having huge responsibilities now in how to counter, how to stop the spread of hate speech. And, you know, one big example was in Myanmar, where there was a lot of hate speech against the Rohingya community. And Facebook is still dealing with the complications of that, given, you know, algorithmic bias, given how complicated, the role of AI is in all this. Also, the difficulty in pinning liability, who is liable and for what. Where does, you know, speech originate, and where is the effect sort of felt? And I feel like there is also effectively an alternative system of justice regulation that now is operating online for several issues. And I think, you know, given the, you know, the echo chambers that exist, given what's called the filter bubble effect and all of this, it's become much easier for sort of dehumanization to take place. And I think standards of what's offensive are also changing rapidly. In terms of regulation, therefore, that becomes a very complicated and difficult thing.
Thank you. So I want to pick up on one of the restrictions that you spoke of, which is hate speech. Hate speech generally speaking, is an attack either on an individual or on a group on the basis of any other identity characteristics like gender, caste, race, etc. I want to talk about hate speech, but also about private censorship that you mentioned on these social media platforms, which become kind of the default infrastructures that we use, and go to Dhanya for this question. So you have been the target of a lot of abuse and harassment on Twitter for a while now. So I want to ask you, not the kinds of private censorship that Twitter offers, but in fact, to what extent does that lead you to self-censoring? And also, if there is this huge effect of self-censorship because of this abuse, how do we go about measuring such a chilling effect, given that we're trying to measure something that we're not doing, that is an omission?
I think, speaking personally, I do self-censor quite a bit now, at least the last 1.5-2 years. There are things that I want to say immediately, and then I stop myself from saying it, because the repercussions of saying that just distracts my attention from my job. Now, that's only because I'm a journalist. I'm sure there are a lot of people whose daily lives are not impacted, whose jobs are not impacted if they don't self-censor. Like, I see a lot of people offering opinions, like, let's take an advocate. They can be more opinionated on social media. They may get abuse, but they don't have to self-censor. But because I'm a journalist, I have to self-censor, because it also affects my job. And anytime I do a story or my portal puts out a story, there is a question of, is there an inherent bias to that story? Which is the reason why I want to self-censor. To the other question of the chilling effect, I think it's not only about self-censoring, but it's also about our perceptions on abuse. Like what you said, what Urmila said, that what we perceive as abuse itself has changed over the years. Like 5 or 6 years ago, I would get offended if someone calls me a prostitute. Now I'm like immune, even if people say they want to rape me, or I've had cases where people said, I will thrust the rod into you. So that's the only time I went to the police. But what the point I'm trying to make is, it's become so normal for people to use the worst kind of abuses, threats, sexual harassment. So I draw the line there. I mean, I'm all for freedom of speech and expression, but if it crosses the line and becomes sexual harassment, if it becomes threat to my life, then yes, I think I have enough rights to approach the police. How does it affect me or anyone else who gets trolled a lot on social media? There are days when I'm not affected at all, but truthfully, there are days when it really bothers me. And I know I reach out to a lot of people, especially women, who I know are under mass abuse. Like, they would be the toast of the day. For 2 or 3 days, there would be articles about them and everyone's trolling them. So I sort of reach out to other women and say that, look, I know what you're going through. Just either switch off for some time or you know, read everything, but just don't process it. Because it's very difficult to suddenly switch off also when you are being abused quite a bit. So I think self-censoring, a lot of people have started doing. I'm very sure of that. And maybe you should get someone next time to ask those who don't self-censor still, like, how do they deal with the day in and day out? I also wonder sometimes.
Thanks for sharing that awful details of that with us. But yeah, I think you make a very interesting point about the relationship between chilling effect and normalization of abuse and how one can be an indicator of the other. So moving from this kind of indirect constraint on free speech, which is abuse, to something which is diagonally opposite, which is internet shutdowns. So the government has in recent times shut down broadband and mobile internet services, either in anticipation of public emergencies or in reaction to these public emergencies. So my question to Sunil is, who is fit to independently review the reasons for shutdowns, given that most of them are carried out in a hurry? And what can aid more, what can help more thoughtful regulation come about when it comes to internet shutdowns?
So I'm going to duck your question, Nandhara, and say that nobody should make a decision about internet shutdowns. That means we shouldn't have internet shutdowns. There are 2 or 3 interesting proposals. There's one proposal from a Singaporean scholar called Ong Peng Wa. He says that you should make the internet unreliable. So that's one way of dealing with the problem. I don't like that solution either, because I think it could fuel violence and confusion.
How do you make the internet unreliable, sorry?
You keep rebooting the towers every now and then. So messages go through, but they unreliably go through. So the solution I like is based on telecom regulation, especially in countries like Spain, where Catalan is a minority language. Then the television channels have a must carry obligation. That means they must carry some Catalan programming. Similarly here, WhatsApp and Facebook and Twitter could have a must carry obligation. This is a very controversial suggestion, but I'm still making it. They must have a must carry obligation. That means if there is a rumor circulating that people are kidnapping children and therefore people are lynching visitors to villages, then for a week or so, you could have a must carry on a counter propaganda or an alternative narrative. And that's why we need this committee. Because if you don't have the committee, the government will use it for their propaganda. So that's the big risk in introducing this obligation. But a committee might reduce this risk.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to use your example to move into the next question. So if we were to have a must-carry obligation, if we were to carry a must-carry obligation and there is enough evidence to suggest that the government in across countries and across political parties, there's enough evidence to suggest that governments are the worst offenders when it comes to misinformation and, you know, what is called, my personal favorite is information disorder, because it might not fit into this box of misinformation or disinformation, but there's something off with it, whether it's propaganda, whether it is provocative messages that are very seductive, whatever that is, right? So given that the government can often be the worst offender, how do we go about dealing with this, one of the biggest crises for journalism, for democracy, etc., that is fake news? And Yeah, it was a question for Dhanya.
Okay, it's about fake news. How do you deal with it?
Yeah.
So I've started to believe that fake news is a misnomer, because if it's fake, it can't be news. We have to say, I think we have to come up with a new word for fake news, but it is a problem, definitely. I don't know if it's a mainstream media problem in India, because the mainstream media, to a large extent, does have some sort of checks and balances. They may misinterpret a news, or they may have a perspective of a news, but I don't think they make news out of thin air and give you. So the fake news problem is largely, as of now, I think, restricted to the internet itself in India. The other day, I saw a post put up by the founder of Alt News, Prateek Sinha. He had actually put up a very interesting post that a lot of fake news, fake memes were spreading using their logo to just tell people that it's actually the truth, because Alt News logo was used on it. So like Sunil said, everything is going to be gamed, right? Like, if you want to spread fake news, the best way is to use a fact checker's logo, and everyone's just going to believe that and spread it further. So as far as journalism is concerned, the only way for mainstream or alternate media to make sure that fake news do not come on our platforms, whether it's television, print, or website, is to first stop looking at speed as one of the biggest elements of journalism. The moment, and in my experience, whenever I have told my reporter to give me a copy fast, 30% of the copy is going to be wrong. So I think it's for the editors, the editorial heads of every news organization to decide that speed should not be an element that you focus on. And then you substantially reduce the number of wrong information going out, I believe. The second is, of course, in more checks and balances within your organization. You have to go back to the roots of journalism, where you check something with one or two sources and then you put it out. The problem now is that, I have seen my own colleagues, WhatsApp, like I was telling Sunil, WhatsApp is such a curse for journalism. There are so many WhatsApp groups of journalists, and one random journalist will put something there. 10 other people will copy paste it on Twitter or Facebook, and no one checks. There's misinterpretation, there is misinformation, everything. So the problem is in the herd mentality. As far as journalists are concerned, if they take away the herd mentality and the factor about speed, I think fake news can come down a lot. But as far as battling fake news on the internet is concerned, that is a really huge battle. But there are people who have taken it on, right? Like, there are websites in India which are only now looking at fake news as something they will counter. But I believe we should move to an era where anything, like if I do a fact check, it has to be published under Creative Commons, where everyone can republish it. I believe any fact check, anything which I disprove a particular news story or fake news which is going the rounds, everyone should be allowed to republish it, because only then we can spread the word. Like, for example, a Boom Live or Alt News, which are your fact check websites in India, they have a very small audience. So how do you make more and more people read it? For example, the Indian Express is a large audience. So if they're going to put out a fact check story, I think they should give permission for everyone to carry it in every language. So we have to start evolving and have more cooperation between media houses. And that's how I think we can really counter fake news. And hopefully we find a new word for it.
Thanks. Those were great points. I want to go back to what Angarika had said about not free speech issues not just being a content issue, but more so also an infrastructure issue. So however many number of fact-checking organizations we might have, they're not transacting with readers directly, and there is this infrastructure in between of people that curate your news for you, like the Facebook algorithm, which is the biggest kind of intermediary for news. So given that so much of our information diets are served by this one algorithm that we don't understand at all, I want to ask Sunil how far we have come in how much have we learned about Facebook algorithm as free speech issue since 2014, which I think was the last time this got a bit of attention?
I think there's several things to say. The first is, if we looked at Cambridge Analytica in particular, what they were using is a standard on the internet called OpenAuth. So there are many websites that don't want to build their own login and logout infrastructure. They're all using this standard. It's a standard developed at the IETF. And the standard says once somebody logs in, they're logged in forever. So those websites were logged in forever, and Cambridge Analytica kept harvesting the data. What Facebook did is it made a modification from the global standard. It said in 3 months, if nobody pulls the data, we're going to expire that login. So that's the big shift they did. But Facebook didn't go back to the IETF and say, this is what we think should happen across the world. Because if they did that, then the problem would be fixed, not just for Facebook, for everybody else, because it would be baked into the standard, like HTTP or HTML are standards. So I think part of the solution is standards. The other part is transparency. So I think in India also, what should be absolutely required is everybody advertising on Facebook, there should be public record of who is advertising, how much money they're spending, what ads they're serving, and who they're targeting. Because if you're driving from the airport to Dumlur, you can see how much a political party has spent on billboards, but this is not possible to tell on a system like Facebook. And then the third thing is, if some content is going viral with a large section of the population, then there should be some way of seeing that outside your own filter bubble, because you can't tell from your own Facebook account that 10% of Bangalore is now consuming a meme that says that India's national anthem is the world's best anthem. You can't tell that. You should be able to tell that so that you can hold Facebook to account. So I think those are the three big fixes that people are discussing both in India and also in other parts of the world.
Thanks. Speaking of upcoming events like the elections, I want to talk a bit about the personal data protection bill draft that recently came out. And it has this thing called the right to be forgotten. Now, the right to be forgotten is part of this new posse of data protection rights, which basically allows individuals to have some degree of control over their online identities. So if I were unhappy with something that Google search is presenting in response to a search query about me, then I can ask for it to be taken down in certain circumstances. However, there are many countries that oppose this because of like historical situations, circumstances, how good their press freedom is, etc. But so given that it has been introduced in India recently and the bill hasn't passed, I want to ask Urmila, how do you see the calls for such a right to be enshrined? And do you think India is ready for such a right?
I don't know if India is ready for such a right, but whether India needs such a right is the question I'm going to answer. Because I think, given what I said earlier about you know, how things are changing online rapidly and in terms of sort of, you know, dehumanization and also all of that and how it ties in with your privacy. The big picture issue that I really want to talk about is what is our notion of justice? What really do we think a justice system should be? And if, you know, reformation, rehabilitation, etc., the basis of that, then forgetting is very important. Because else we are going to remember people's, you know, faults, offenses, convictions, wrongful prosecutions, which are very, very common in India, for a long time to come. It's recorded on the internet forever. So it's very important that people have a right to erasure, whatever we call that, whether forgetting or, you know, but erasure from records online. For instance, I was working at the Supreme Court. I was a law clerk to a judge. And one case we worked on was the Akshardham terror attack case, where five people were on death row and then they were acquitted by the Supreme Court after several years. And, you know, what of them now? The records are online for all time to come. How do they reintegrate back into society? Do people believe that they are actually innocent now? And therefore, don't they have a right to be forgotten, in a sense? So I think given how broken India's criminal justice system is, it's very important for us to think carefully about how this right can operate. But I do think we need one. And who decides on, you know, which information can get erased and how it balances with other interests such as, you know, public interest, right to information, and of course, free speech and expression.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, that's a very pertinent point on the criminal justice system. I want to come back to Angarika. I'm sorry we haven't come to you yet, but I thought the infrastructure question fits well towards the end. And I believe, I mean, do I get this correct that you work on building alternative media infrastructures for communities? And if you agree with that definition of your work, then how does ownership and management over media infrastructures relate to free speech?
So at Mara, we've been working for a long time with community radio. So we set up the first few radio stations when the policy came out. And since then, we've been sort of helping stations with broadcast, with research, with training. So we've had a chance to, I guess, investigate quite closely the workings of the community radio sector in particular. And the question of ownership is quite pertinent there because, as the name would suggest, community radio started with the promise of being something that would be owned and managed and listened to by a specific geographical community. But we recently did a ownership study 2 years ago, and what we found was that there are these high degrees of political, religious, and corporate stakes within the community radio sector. So if you log on to the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting's website, you can see that document which kind of traces who's been given a license for radio and who hasn't. And the absence is quite revealing because, for example, large parts of central India will not be given a license. Likewise for the Northeast or Kashmir. And the people who are getting the licenses in those areas is, for example, the CRPF. So it is quite a clear indication in terms of how censorship and how ownership kind of works in that front. The second thing has been that there's been an intermeshing of media and politics for a long time. So there's political parties, corporate groups that have stakes in the media. And even though the regulator, TRAI, has kind of made specific recommendations on media ownership, these have been ignored by the public as well as with as well as by political parties. So the crucial pressure point, which is licensing, has been kind of circumvented by most parties. So in, like, for example, recently the government kind of denied a bunch of licenses to NGOs and progressive groups, but gave the license for Republic TV's Hindi channel. So that kind of begins to shape a particular thing. So I think with licensing criteria, something that we've kind of been trying to push has been to look at diversity rather than net worth or revenue. And because media has begun to run as a business, but is actually a lot more of a social good, I think what needs to kind of be pushed is diversity in terms of ownership, in terms of language, in terms of staff, audience, and content. And that kind of brings us back to the question of how free speech is not only a content question, but also one of infrastructure. And there have been some successful movements in South Africa, Australia, Canada, where there's been people's movements trying to hold the media accountable. But that's not taken off in the country, maybe because the centrality of media in terms of shaping discourse or in shaping sort of the symbolic resources of the country is not taken very seriously yet. But I think until there is that kind of a push, we'll kind of see the same pattern repeating.
Thanks. I think that was a great way of putting that it's not just about content, but about infrastructure. But I also want to ask you where it's not just about infrastructure and something else. So as our data packs get cheaper and, mobile penetration increases, are there other issues of accessibility that go beyond economic costs and network density? Like, so if there is infrastructure, does that bridge the gap of access?
Yeah, there are maybe 3 points that I'd kind of like to elaborate on with this. Aside from the point about in terms of communication technologies and infrastructure and the access there, the internet is largely still dominated by English. And this kind of becomes sort of a chicken and egg situation, because the internet is largely, the content is user generated. And there aren't enough users or content with respect to other languages. So this becomes a problem, because users will be attracted to the internet if there is content that speaks to their experiences and if they feel that there is space for self-representation and other voices. But there's the content also reflects people who are using the internet. The third is something that I kind of mentioned earlier, which was around social realities, which have not really caught up with technological innovation. So whether it's in terms of families and communities, and specifically specifically with regard to women, their control and access to technology is not directly a question of free speech, perhaps, but it does kind of address the, raise the point of who participates on the internet, and then how, with if there are only specific communities that are kind of being represented, as we saw with Me Too, for example, it does begin to shape discourse and vocabulary around a given issue in a particular way, which misrepresents or entirely ignores quite a large part of the country's population. And the last part, the last point I want to make is also that questions of access and participation often assume that there's a common public sphere and also now a common online public sphere, which in turn would lead to an improvement in democracy or in terms of a diversity in caste and class relations and conversations. But since internet access is still largely mobile-based and app-based, it's more peer-to-peer than it is really a homogeneous public sphere. And all of these simultaneous fears on the internet in some ways actually mirror exactly the way society is organized otherwise. So WhatsApp groups or Facebook will rarely allow for outsiders in a sense, and often they amplify existing inequalities in terms of who is a part of them or the kind of discourse that they're pushing. So even though there is a lot of talk about the internet being inclusive, I think from our work, we found that often it mirrors social exclusions and can also further divide those in a way.
Thank you. I hope that has given a slice of the kinds of issues about freedom of speech and expression on the internet. So now if the audience has any questions, now's the time. Okay, I think we're out of time now. Thank you for being such a fantastic panel. I learned a lot. I don't know. I hope you did too. And thanks for coming out on a Sunday evening.
Thank you for tuning in to the live show of Awaaz Do, a freedom of speech and expression on the internet panel discussion. You can follow us at Express Podcasts on Twitter and Facebook, and you can subscribe to us so you can find more of our work. If you enjoyed the live show, find us on social media, and we'd love to come down to your city and do some more.